So, good afternoon, everyone. It's almost 2:30, so we'll start. I'm Jigna Darur, going to moderate this session. And as you all may know, this session is sponsored by Caucus for Immigrants and Refugee Health. And in the case of this session, we'll have five speakers today, and each will speak for approximately 12 minutes. And they all will present their work continuously, so we'll have Q&As in the end. So save your questions for the end. So without further delay, let me introduce the first speaker of the session, Sylvia Tursky-Bumgardner. Did I say it right? She is a faculty member in the Department of Public Health at Temple University, where she concentrates on issues of policy as they intersect with health outcomes. So, Sylvia.
So, anybody who's been exposed to the media lately understands that why I'm looking at state adoption of restrictive policy. We've all seen with Alabama, it can have a real impact on immigrant groups and communities. So I wanted to take a look and see what is it about states, what economic characteristics, what demographic characteristics, what political characteristics are behind states adopting these type of restrictive legislations. I have no relationships to disclose. The nature of the American family has been changing over time, which is the impetus behind this study. So the idea of the American family as seen through the 1950s sitcom, if it ever was real, is no longer real. As we've seen with the American Community Survey, there are over 14.6 million U.S. citizen children living in families where one or more of the parents are immigrants. And these immigrant parents could be naturalized U.S. citizens, they could be legal immigrants, or they could be undocumented immigrants. But it's very important to look at policy that affects immigrants, because that policy will also affect the U.S. citizen children that are living in these immigrant households. As you can see by this slide, as the percentage of Native children living in Native families has declined over time, specifically since 2000, a similar proportion of Native children, U.S. citizen children, living in families with immigrant parents, one or more immigrant parents, have actually increased proportionally. So the 10 states that I've included in this preliminary analysis are actually states that have experienced the highest percentage increase in immigrant population in the time period that I'm looking at, which is 2000 to 2008. And if you'll notice, Alabama is included in that analysis. So while these states are not traditional receiving states, so they don't have the largest number of immigrant population, they've experienced the greatest immigration pressure over time, which may be a driver behind the adoption of restrictive policies. I want to give you a small picture of the federal environment and how that affects the state environment. So we all know that the federal government determines immigration policy, but the states are the place where the immigrant actually interacts in terms of access to social services and is able to integrate or not integrate based on that interaction. So the federal environment really changed in 1996 with the passage of PROA, and this sea change was that before, immigrants, legal immigrants, had the same access to our social safety net as U.S. citizens did. And then after 1996, that all changed, except for a small section of protected immigrants. And even they had restricted access. And because of this, it barred access for the first 5 years in the country. Supposedly, immigrants were not ever able to get food stamps unless they became U.S. citizens, which changed a little bit over time. And it also created this idea of deeming of sponsors, so that the amount above the poverty level actually changed in order to be a sponsor for an immigrant family to 125% of the federal poverty level. And it became possible for the federal government to go after these sponsors for the money if their immigrants that they sponsored had to access any type of social service, which of course created a climate of fear. And this climate of fear has been well documented to affect not just the small percentage of immigrants that it was actually intended to affect, but a larger percentage of immigrants and actually U.S. citizen children living in immigrant households. And this is what's titled the chilling effect. And there are a number of studies that show that that even immigrants who had the right to access the social safety net, their use declined significantly over time across all social safety net services, because not because of the realities of the law, but because of the perceptions of the law. And we see this also in Alabama, where the law actually is just taking in aggregate data in terms of children in the public school system, but the families are so afraid and they don't understand what's happening, and therefore there are a lot of families that chose not to take their kids to school. So it's not the actual law, it's the perception of the law that creates this effect and has this adverse impact on immigrant families and U.S. citizen children living in these immigrant families. Another important thing to realize is that this sort of constituted a devolution of authority from the federal government to the state. And the reason that that's true is because the federal government gave the states the authority to either make up for some of those services they were taking away or to further restrict those services, as we see with the CHIPRA legislation. So when CHIP was reenacted, they said, well, you can give back services if you want to legal pregnant women and children in terms of access to state CHIP services. So it was up to the states. So the federal government gave the states more leeway, which means that the state policy environment became even more critical in terms of looking at what immigrant families had access to. So it's important to realize that the states enact legislation that basically enable immigrants to integrate or not integrate into these communities. And this legislation falls under a number of categories. And these categories include things like the ability to get IDs, include things like the ability to access employment, and the ability to access education. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that in detail. The years 2000 to 2008 were chosen for this analysis because it was after the PROA legislation. It had enough time for the PROA legislation to take effect, so hopefully there wasn't any confounding due to that. But this period also saw a large increase in the number of restrictive legislation that was passed. These were the search terms that I used in order to identify the policies, and this was adopted from something the Migration Policy Institute had done. So the whole idea, I used those search terms to find laws that actually used immigration as a screening characterization, as something that was either inclusionary or exclusionary for any type of service. And then once I found that, I categorized the laws as either restrictive or non-restrictive. Non-restrictive laws were laws that either kept access or social services the same or increased the access to social services. And then I further categorized these laws as dealing with education, regulation, or social welfare. Education was anything dealing with access to funding for secondary education or access to the public education system. Regulation is a bit broader category, as you'll see in a couple of slides, and that deals with regulation around law enforcement, being able to work in concert with federal immigration authorities, having to do with requiring screening, either at the federal level, the state level, or individual employers to screen, or saying that based on citizenship status or immigration status, certain people couldn't be licensed for certain types of jobs were all included under regulation. And social welfare was anything that either increased access or decreased access to any type of social safety net program. I did not include funding bills. I did not include anything that was not actually a law, but was saying, well, we should think about this kind of thing or we should do research. That was not included under this. Also, I didn't include any laws that dealt with alien corporations, only with individuals. So this is what it looks like in these 10 states. These are the number of restrictive laws by state and year, and surprise, surprise, Alabama is by far the leader. But don't count out South Carolina, because they have a rather comprehensive immigration bill that they passed in 2008 that was very restrictive. And as you can see, the number of laws started increasing right around 2005. This is when we see the majority of increase in this restrictive legislation. And this is not all legislation, this is just restrictive legislation. This is the type of restrictive laws that were passed. And as you can see, in the beginning, it was really social service type of laws as sort of an outgrowth of the PROA legislation. But as time changed, really regulation took over, and regulation of employment became really important. And this regulation of employment right here is almost all Alabama. In 2008, Alabama passed these huge number of laws basically saying that you can't be licensed to do any number of jobs if you're a non-citizen or not in certain legal categories. Law enforcement was also a very popular type of law passed, and these law enforcement regulations allowed local law enforcement officials to act as immigration officials. It allowed for screening of people for their immigration status as they came into the court system. So there's a variety of laws that fall under law enforcement, and regulation for ID is a relatively small percentage of the laws that were passed. So why am I even looking at why states adopt? One of the reasons that I'm looking at it is further analysis that I intend to do. So this is the first stage of the analysis, and I want to look and see, do state laws actually affect how children access social services, U.S. citizen children and immigrant families? So the same chilling effect that we saw under the federal legislation, does that occur at the state level? And I also wanted to broaden the expanse of laws that we're looking at. So it's not just social service use laws, but things like anything that helps an immigrant integrate into society, like access to education or access to employment. So because of this, I had to address the problem of endogeneity, and this is my first attempt at that. So the people who are passing these laws for a particular reason. They have an outcome they want to achieve. So I have to understand what are the drivers behind those outcomes so I can include them in my equations later on to make sure that I account for that and that the results that I find are actually legitimate results. So what I did right now is I took the data for the states, and I'm going to talk to you about the variables that I used. And I put it into both a linear and logistic regression equation. The logistic regression was a good fit, but the significance was the same across both the linear and logistic regressions. And so since the outcomes are easier to interpret in the linear regression, the coefficients are easier to interpret, that's the ones that I used here. And I looked at whether a state, these 10 states that I'm looking at time t, any time between 2000 and 2008, what are the characteristics of the state that might cause them to adopt this type of restrictive legislation. So these are the Y adopt variables that I chose. And as you can see, the economic variables have things to do with as the economy goes down and as unemployment goes up, I assumed that the state would be more likely to adopt restrictive legislation, especially since we saw a lot of the restrictive legislation has to do with employment. The political affiliation, I assumed that Republicans' control of the government would have an increase in restrictive legislation because of their platform on immigration and social service use. Both suggest that. The demographic characteristics, I was looking at education, I was looking at immigration pressure, I was looking at percent of non-citizens because these laws are aimed at non-citizens, and I was also looking at a dichotomy between this population of the state and the immigrant population, and I assumed that if the immigrants that were coming in were from different race or ethnicities or had different cultural backgrounds, that might increase the chances of these restrictive legislations being adopted. I put in a time dummy variable to say what are things that might have happened over time across these states that I might have forgotten about to control for that. And I put in state fixed effects in order to find anything that that was invariant within the state that I might have missed. So what did I actually find? I was very surprised that things like Republican control, political control, had absolutely no significance. What did have significance at the 5% level was median income. So that was found to be significant. As the income went up, people were less likely to adopt restrictive legislation. At the 10% significance level, states with a greater proportion of college graduates were less likely to enact restrictive legislation. And states with a greater proportion of foreign-born population, this immigrant pressure, were more likely to enact this type of restrictive legislation. Unfortunately, when I put in the state fixed effects, all the significance sort of washed away. So that means that I have some characteristic within the state that doesn't change over time that I'm not accounting for. And I think that one of those things I might be able to pick up on is sort of state values, and I'm going to look at that by looking at whether after the PRO legislation they enacted legislation to help these immigrants recover some of the services that they had previously lost, and then hopefully that'll bring back some of the significance. So next steps is to put this into a difference in difference equation to look at does this actually create that type of chilling effect? I'm also going to put in states that are traditional receiving states so that I can see if there's a difference when I add those states in terms of total immigrant population. And the whole idea behind this is maybe understanding why states adopt can help drive advocacy groups to create some type of social change and awareness so that there aren't these unanticipated consequences on U.S. citizen children from these laws. Thank you.